This Resources Committee will come to order at 8 minutes after eight at the request of one of our representatives. Would the record show that Representatives Cott, Osterman, Ogun, Williams, and Green are present? And I thank you. I appreciate that. We were last on Senate Bill 93. I don't see the sponsor. Oh, yes, there she is. We were talking, I believe, at one time we were concerned, and I think Representative Ogun has asked again. And for the record, I wonder, Ron, could you come up and answer a couple of questions about that which may be conveyed? We touched on it lightly, but is there anything that can be done in the conveyance, which I'm sure will be some at least, any kind of conveyance for priority use, or is that an encumbrance that you can't convey when you convey to, say, a native corporation? And of course, the concept is that would there be any merit to trying to do that so that in the future, if Yukon Pacific were to come across some land that has been conveyed between now and the time they're ready to take ownership of the land, that would at least not impede the construction of a pipeline.
Mr. Chairman, Ron Swanson, Director, Division of Land. For any lease that we would issue, we could do that with a stipulation. Land that we convey to the borough, of course, would be basically an unencumbered land, and we could not do that. But I would hope we would deal with that provision before we would convey it to the borough. And if they would accept it with an encumbrance such as that, we would certainly do so, but I would not expect they would.
Uh-huh. But to any other private ownership, you could do that?
Certainly we could.
Representative Ogun?
Thank you. Mr. Swanson, is it my understanding that the right-of-ways are in place for the natural gas pipeline at this time?
Mr. Chairman, the application is in place. The right-of-way is not in place, but we are well aware of the application and make it subject to that.
Is there anything at all in this bill that would possibly impede their ability to build a pipeline, assuming that all the stars and the moons and whatever else have to do to line up to make this project happen? Is there anything at all in this bill that would impede their that development?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ogun, absolutely not.
Does the record show that Representative Davies has joined us? Oh. You know, the questions about rights of way, or we have a map over there for the committee's perusal if interested. It shows the Dalton Highway, and there's a demarcation of several of the points of areas that we were talking about, Coalfoot and et cetera. If it's of interest to the committee to take a short break and look at that, or if you're familiar enough with it, we can just forge ahead. Looks like we're ready to forge ahead. Are there any other questions? Well, thank you, Ron. Any other questions that pertain to either the sponsor or any action on the bill that any of the members would care to take? We don't have any teleconference, do we? Representative Davies.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment. Does everybody have a copy?
Is this G3 Utimol?
No, that was...
G5. I've got a G5
on
this.
Oh.
I don't know what we did. We did adopt G3? The North Fork one? I believe you did. We did G3.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. Okay, G5. You're wrong.
Mr. Chair, in thinking about the... I raised some concerns last time about being realistic about the fact that along with the responsibility, along with, you know, opening up the highway and some of the opportunities, there are some responsibilities that we have, and trying to think about how our declining state revenues are going to cover the costs of providing those for those responsibilities along the highway. It seemed to me that, that this might be one instance where we ought to consider at least the possibility of a toll. And I spent some time looking at that. It seemed to me that the simplest way to do that would be to establish a, what I would assume would be a one-way toll on the E.L. Patton Bridge at the Yukon River. Now, I know the Department of Transportation, I actually requested and I'm very grateful for an enormous amount of information that I got from the Department of Transportation on this issue. They've obviously spent some time already thinking about that. And I've also discovered that, that they do have in the statutes the authority to impose tolls on any highway in the state of Alaska.
Except I think the Marine Highway.
The Marine Highway already effectively has tolls on it because you have to pay a fare.
I
think that the Marine Highway is actually, you know, one of those cases where, you know, a significant fraction of the cost of the operation of the system is paid by the users. And I think that in certain instances, while I wouldn't be in favor of this as a general proposition, you know, for the entire state, in this case, this is such a unique situation, and the costs are large. The difficulty of maintenance and the remoteness of the area are going to, I think, be a significant drain on the general fund of the state of Alaska if we don't consider some kind of additional revenue source that relates to the operation of that highway. So for that reason, I would propose that we consider establishing a toll. Now, in reviewing the Department of Transportation materials, they have estimated that it would be a relatively high cost to implement this, and I'm a little bit concerned about that. I don't want to have a toll established, and maybe, Mr. Chair, perhaps I should move the amendment so we have something to discuss.
Okay, that would probably be a good idea.
Mr. Chair, I would move Amendment G5.
Any objection?
Object
to discussion.
Anyway, just to finish that thought, I'm certainly not interested in a toll that whose only purpose would be to pay for the collection of the toll. And there is, depending on how it would be implemented, there is some possibility that we might be at least in a large measure in that posture. So, what in offering this, it's my hope that the department could consider some automated means of collecting tolls that would reduce the administrative costs considerably over their existing estimates. Their existing estimates include things, for example, as building housing for the people who are going to collect the tolls, and, you know, fairly significant capital costs, which I think can be avoided if the plan were reconsidered. So it's in that it's from that point of view and in that spirit that I offer this amendment.
While we're under discussion, I'm wondering, Sam, would you mind coming forward and being available for questions? I know this is catching you flat-footed, but please identify yourself for the record.
Sam Keto, Department of Transportation, Legislative Liaison.
Did you have a question?
Well, I guess I don't know if it's a question. I'm a little concerned as Representative Davies says that what the traffic count has been on that road. I don't know a whole lot about it other than to understand that it's open, that it's going to remain open by law, by court order. I don't know how the department would handle the toll either, because if I understand it correctly, the majority of the use at this point in time is commercial on that road, and would you have a higher fee for trucks that are causing more damage to the road than a small car? How would the toll be handled? And have they done traffic counts to see what the usage is, and have they need that for, you know, expand that out into some kind of dollar figure to see what the cost is to? Those are the kind of questions I'd have to have answered before I could vote yes or no on this.
Representative Davies.
You know, the department does have traffic counts, and they have making an assumption that they would impose a toll based on the a sort of a linear number, an estimate based on the number of axles of vehicles. So using that number, I think they made their most reasonable estimate So the toll would be $20 for a passenger vehicle and $50 for a truck, for example. In that order.
Yes, Representative Williams?
It's a sponsor, think of this.
What does the sponsor think of such an amendment?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Teresa Sager. I work for Senator Mike Miller, who couldn't be here this
Excuse
morning.
Excuse me, could you come up so that we can pick that up? I'm going to ask you if you would identify yourself again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Teresa Sager, staff to Senator Mike Miller. Senator Miller had just a moment to review the amendment and indicated that he was not supportive. He did mention the impact that the toll would have on industry as well as the private traveling public. He wanted the committee to consider the impact of allowing the commissioner to establish the toll through regulation. And also the committee might wish to consider whether this amendment would fit within the title of the bill. I don't know if it does, but he wanted me to bring that to the committee's attention.
Representative Davies?
With to the last comment, this amendment does amend the title of the bill.
If that is the feeling, then our aides have brought a point up that amendments to bills from the other house, that an amendment to a bill introduced in the other house is not in order if the amendment requires a change in the title of the bill. So while this is maybe interesting discussion, apparently it is out of order unless in fact, this says if it would require a change of the bill, title of the bill.
That's a resolution. Two-thirds vote.
Yeah.
Resolution.
Well, and isn't it true that Representative Davies had gotten some information from DOT that it's
Chairman.
Already permissible? I mean, you already have the authority to install it.
We do already have the regulatory authority or the statutory authority to put in place regulations for the bridge or for the highway, and we have looked at this extensively. It's something that I think the commissioner may take another look at.
The concern I might have is if it is essentially commercial and those people, especially Alyeska, have been taken care of activities along the road now, would we then impact them to the point of every time they go back and forth across the bridge in their normal duties, that would be another toll? And
Mr. Chairman, that was another issue that was brought up in the study, and we have signed an agreement with Alyeska that we will not charge them for the use of the road. That's something that we would have to work out policy-wise, but we might only be able to collect a toll from the non-commercial users of the facility.
Not knowing what the the traffic count of non-commercial users would be, do you have any kind of a ballpark figure on that? Is there enough traffic that it would offset the cost to administer a toll?
Mr. Chairman,
whatever it would be?
In the study that we have done, the costs would be taken care of by the toll for the Yukon River Bridge. If I recall correctly, it is about 70% of the revenue generated would go to pay for the administrative costs of the program at the present time.
Okay, so it would be a slight moneymaker.
Right.
Representative Ogie?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in other words, Alyeska Pipeline and their subcontractors or people that are servicing the pipeline, also known as the truckers, could possibly not have to pay a toll on that? Is that the way?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ogan, that is one of the interpretations of the agreement that we have with Alyeska.
Okay. Representative Ogan.
What is the agreement you have then? I'm kind of confused. This road was put in by industry to service the slope. Now it's a state road, and the state has maintained. Does the state run graders up and down that road?
Mr. Chairman, if I may discuss a little bit of the history of the
Please do.
Road, Representative Osterman. The road actually was built with some participation of federal highway funding. There was an agreement that when the pipeline was open to service, that the road would be turned over to the state. The state would be responsible for maintenance of that roadway for the term of the usage of the pipeline.
So it has, in a sense, become a state road. There are several attorney general opinions. There is an opinion in 1976 that reviewed the possibilities of full closure of the road once the pipeline had been built to full opening of the road once the pipeline had been built. A decision had been made in 1978 to go with a regulatory restriction on the use of the road. From 1978 until almost 1990, it was a permitted road. I don't believe they've actually enforced the permit requirement for about the past 5 years. That's just kind of a brief history. We have responsibility for the road, and it has federal funding. So as long as the road is opened, we can put federal money into it to repair it. The road actually legislatively was opened up to Dietrich Camp in 1991 and is only closed now from Dietrich Camp up to Prudhoe Bay. Or was only closed, I should say. It's open now.
Representative Davies?
Well, as I understand from reading some of the materials that you provided to me, that this part of the agreement in this arrangement of the industry participating in the construction of the road and the state taking over and maintaining it was that the state would not impose a toll on the use of the road.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Davies, I understood that the toll was not to be assessed against Alyeska Pipeline as a user of the road.
Right.
Not that we would not charge
right.
a toll on the
right.
road.
I understand correctly. That's what I meant to say here. So I think that certainly that agreement needs to be honored in any regulations that would be adopted.
Any other discussion on the amendment?
Well, if the amendment is, are you ruling it out of order? Or what are you doing?
I wanted to get as much discussion on it so that we'll have a at least in the record, should this come back up down the road or come back from the floor or whatever might happen, rather than just rush out over it. So I wanted to get the information in the record. And then
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Hogan?
So if we have a toll on there, it'll 70% of the cost of tolls will be absorbed in administration overhead. Do you have any idea, are we talking about, a $20 toll? Or do you have a figure set for the tolls? And if you do, how much revenue would be generated above and beyond administrative costs? And is there any, this is a long question, but is there any estimated cost as to what the state spends as far as emergency services and other costs associated with taking care of the tourists that go up there and get in trouble?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hogan, as far as the costs of administration of the toll facility, if we just have the toll at the bridge, the toll would just service the bridge, we would, as I said, the estimate is 70% would go to administrative costs, 30% would go to actual maintenance of the bridge. Because of the way our arrangement is with Federal Highway Administration, the way their regulations are set up, we would not be able to use any of that money for public safety or emergency services until we have fulfilled our requirement to maintain the bridge. The same thing with the highway. If we were to impose a toll that would allow us to maintain the entire highway, then we would be able to cover our administrative costs, pay for maintenance of the highway, and only after that had been done would we be able to spend some money on public safety and emergency services.
You indicated 70% of the toll would go toward operations. You must have some feel then for what the toll amount would be?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The toll, recommended toll, in the study that was completed approximately a year and a half ago was $20 for passenger vehicles and $40 or $50, I believe, for truck traffic that was not part of the Alyeska agreement.
Representative Cott?
Mr. Chairman, 70% of the money is collected to go toward administrative costs, and I can see where that would come into effect. And I also could see that, depending on the amount of traffic crossing the Yukon River, you could increase or decrease the toll amount respectively. If we had one car per 3 days and you still wanted to cover 70% of the administrative cost plus, the toll could be elevated to $50 or $100. I guess the real question I have, in considering tolls up there, if someone were to cross the Yukon Bridge and went to Old Man versus, let's say, going up to Prudhoe Bay, is it the same toll? We're going 10 miles versus 300 miles? Or
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cott, yes, it would be if the toll were imposed for the Yukon River Bridge. It would be solely for that facility and not for the entire facility, so they would be paying for the use of just the bridge.
If Mike, then.
So if they went across the bridge to the other side of the bridge and went back, they would still be required to pay the toll.
The receipts that are generated by that toll would go into the general fund, or would it be available for the department to maintain the road?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cott, the receipts, as far as I know, would go into the general fund. The department would be responsible for administering the toll, and that would have to come out of the departmental budget.
In that case, Mr. Chairman, I think that $20 or $15 is a little bit much. I don't ever recall crossing a bridge paying $10 or $15. I would much rather see a toll booth established somewhere at the crossing of the Canadian-Alaskan border, and thereby capturing every individual that comes into the state at a much reduced rate, $2 a car or whatever.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Representative Williams.
I think we're talking about something that we can't deal with in this committee right now, and I'd prefer that we rule this amendment out of order. It says here in the uniform rules that a committee of the second house may not report a committee substitute for a bill or an amendment to a bill that requires a change in the title of the bill rather than a clerical or something to that effect.
I appreciate that, and as I mentioned, the reason I was taking input on this is because I did want to establish a record. But I would plan to invoke this rule from the is Rule 24D as in dog that Representative Williams was referring to out of the Uniform Rules of Alaska State Legislature. And so I would request that the maker of the amendment withdraw it. Otherwise, I will have to consider it out of order.
I would withdraw it if the committee feels that the title change is required. I offered the amendment. I was cognizant of the rule. I guess there's some question in my mind as whether the title change was in fact required.
Unless the committee would want to vote on it, it would be my opinion that it would require, since we're talking about land going one way in the title and now we're talking about a toll. To me, they are two separate subjects. The motion has been withdrawn. Any other comments? Any other questions to the sponsor or to Department of Transportation? Any questions of the Department of Natural Resources? If not, what's the wish of the committee? Representative Osterman?
Yeah, I would move CS for Senate Bill 93 as amended.
Object for purposes of a brief discussion.
Objection has been noted. Representative Davies?
Mr. Chair, I wonder if the committee would consider a letter of intent from the committee to request the commissioner to continue their consideration of revenue raising measures.
Representative Osterman?
I'm a strong believer in user fees. From what I've heard today, putting the burden of that toll on the individual user rather than on the toll user of that road would be inappropriate. If the agreement wasn't in place where the industry was exempt from tolls, I would probably agree with you. But I would have to object, I guess, to the intent based on that fact alone. I agree with Representative Cott, maybe we're talking about tolls, let's go where it's really be effective.
Any other discussion?
Yeah, maybe just the south side of Fairbanks.
Right in front of your house.
Do you still want, would you want a roll call vote on that request?
No, it sounds like since the committee is not supportive, so I'll withdraw.
Okay. Any other comments, questions, or statements? And there has been a motion to move with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes. Is there any further objection? Hearing none, motion committee. I thought I saw him here earlier. That brings us up to House Bill 258, which is an act relating to the compensation for agents who sell licenses and tags for the Department of Fish and Game. Sponsor is Representative Bundy, and I understand... Oh, there he is.
Okay. As we speak.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members.
Excuse me, just one moment. Yes. Representative Nicolai joined us about 5 minutes ago. Let the record reflect. Representative Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, again. The purpose of HB 258 is to place a cap on the amount of compensation vendors receive for selling hunting, fishing, trapping license and tags. Currently, the state compensates vendors by allowing them to retain 5% of the fee charge for each license, plus an additional compensation at the end of the year. The additional compensation received by the vendor amounts to $50 a year or $1 per tag or license, whichever is greater. House Bill 258 would cap vendor compensation at $10,000 per year. The result of the cap will be that Fish and Game fund savings of $212,104 per year. Note that at a time when we've had to reduce Fish and Game budget that it gives me particular pleasure to have the opportunity to talk about increasing even amounts that are in the sub-millions. The new cap will, in varying degrees, affect only 4% of the people who write hunting and fishing licenses, 4% of the vendors. The vendors will lose some of the state subsidy, that's true, but they will retain the ability to sell license, of course, which is a service to the public and also a leader in that it increases traffic. People come in, buy their hunting or fishing license, and while they're there, they pick up some of the things they need to pursue their interest in that. At least that's my personal experience, and I think we find that that has happened with many other people who hunt and fish. This legislation saves the state money while allowing vendors to recover their actual expenses. And in addition, to vendors, as I said, continue to sell these items, which is a service to the state but increases customer traffic in their stores. I certainly encourage you to look closely at this bill and hopefully find positive consideration. Jaron Bruce is with us from the department. They were instrumental in the crafting of this legislation, and so I'm certainly available for questions, but would encourage questions directed at him as well.
Excuse me, are there any questions? Yes, Representative Cott.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, I don't have a question, but I must declare a conflict of interest. My wife works for the number one, looks like, vendor in the state, issues licenses, and I'm going to abstain from voting on this.
I would say, is this where I object?
Unfortunately.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might just add on, I have, I believe I have some personal experience that might give some credibility in this area. I have both worked for a sporting goods store that sold license. I've written license. And perhaps declaring some version of a conflict, I currently work for, in summers, for a company who sells a great many licenses, particularly to non-residents. An air taxi company provides the hunting and fishing license as a service, and being under the philosophy what's good for the goose is good for the gander, I believe in my research that the company I work for would probably lose about $1,000 a year in compensation. So I'm not just asking others to take the loss. I'm willing to ask us all to step up.
Representative Osterman?
I've talked to Representative Bundy about it, and I'm in opposition to this because I've also spent time in doing this, and I see it just a little bit different than he does because of the amount of, while it does generate traffic into your store, it also generates a headache. Having people there, having extra employees do it, while it does generate more money for the stores, it also takes the burden off of fish and game. I don't know whether some of the stars would try to back out of it at all if they were on the borderline of being capped on the amount of money. And it is a service that we also do to the state, not only a service to the people. The reason that we're doing this is so fish and game doesn't have to have the burden of trying to sell licenses. Everybody comes to the state too. So. I just see it a little different than Representative Bundy does.
excuse me, Mr. Bruce, would you mind stepping up? I've got at least one question, and maybe some others. I'm sorry.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jaron Bruce, representing Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Jaron, if this were to happen and Joe Sixpack has always been getting his license at either 1 through 4, and he gets down there after the $10,000, and then he's got to go to Fish and Game or someplace else, I guess. It doesn't matter, but he just can't go to one of these four major outlets or whoever has gone over $10,000. Is this going to create a havoc with the guy who is planning to go fishing at 6 o'clock tonight and went by the store and they can't do it anymore? Or they can continue to write them, but they won't get any money. Will you see that they'll stop issuing licenses? Or I'm looking down the road at a real problem. Now he misses his fishing trip because he doesn't have a license. He can't get the fishing game. They're closed.
Mr. Chairman, of course it's somewhat speculative, but they would continue to sell licenses, to have the ability to sell licenses, whether or not they had reached a point in compensation at which their compensation was capped, the $10,000 figure here, regardless of whether they had reset or not, they would still be in the business of selling licenses. So that shouldn't affect an individual expecting to go fishing. I can't imagine a store that would sell them up to that point and then stop selling them. I think they would either choose to sell them at all or continue selling them. If I understand your question correctly, I don't think it would affect an individual who was planning a fishing trip and should not result in any less availability of licensed vendors.
Well, what I was thinking about, the statement was made that some of these vendors get as much as $50,000, so this would say that they would be selling 80% of their licenses at no compensation, and I'm wondering if they would continue to do that. Will this pull out of the stream those convenience stores that may be open all night or that would be open certainly later than an 8 to 5 operation?
Mr. Chairman, may I add a
Representative
comment?
Bundy?
The highest compensation is only $35,000, only in 35 maybe.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But in any case, remember, and that applies to each vendor, not to, say, a corporation like Cars or Long's. So each of their stores could sell up to $35,000, rather than just that corporate entity sell up to $10,000 in this case now. But I would like to encourage you to think about the competitive nature of the retail business and how important mm-hmm. service aspect is. And in your first scenario, if someone was offering a service and then suddenly chopped it off,
I think the adverse customer reaction would be something that they would not be inclined to generate. And again, in my experience, sometimes having in the last minute needed to look for a license, there are lots and lots of vendors. Would a store choose not to provide these anymore? Again, the competitive nature of retail business, I think, would there's lots of vendors.
The other thing, and I have just one other question on that same line, the fiscal note reflects the, as I understand the fiscal note, it says that by capping out this additional fee, they will continue to sell them because then this fee that would have been paid won't be paid, and that'll come back to Fish and Game. So what I'm hearing, I think, is that they'll either go ahead and sell them at the store that has reached its cap, or they won't go to another store, because if it's a store that's under the cap, that would not be money coming back to Fish and Game. So it's a presumption, I guess, on this fiscal note that they would go ahead and sell just as before. Okay. Representative Osterman?
Well, I guess my contention is that what we're asking these 4% of the vendors in the state of Alaska is to supplement Fish and Game's budget. And I don't know why we're asking 4% of the vendors in the state of Alaska to supplement the Fish and Game's budget when we're not asking the rest of the 96% of the vendors in the state to supplement the budget of Fish and Game. And if number one up here, Long's Drug, does gross sales of $420,000 in licenses, then I'm assuming that somewhere along the way that they're expending money to do that with their employees and everything else, while their only compensation is $35,000 out of the $420,000 sales. So I'm having a hard time coming to grips with supplementing Fish and Game's budget out of 4% of the businesses that are selling licenses.
Representative Bundy?
Mr. Chairman, and just a couple of comments, and Representative Osterman, he and I have discussed this, and it's in one of those areas where reasonable people disagree. And so we're not in any controversy here. But one, I think it's safe to assume that the volume of the license will continue. The demand for license will continue, and the people will go to where they can get the service. And so that foot traffic that generates a lot of income for retail outlets will continue. And I would guess turn the discussion around a little bit. Why is the state of Alaska subsidizing certain retail outlets to much higher level than it's going to cost them to write the license and not subsidizing the others? As I said, I've written license. It takes about a minute. In most cases, the clerk gives you the license, says, fill this out. They punch it right in the store's name, and you're on your way. Now, there is some record keeping that goes on in addition to writing the license, and that's there's no question there's some time consumed there. But I would again also say the other 59 minutes of the hour that clerk is there, they're doing store work, and they aren't, in my opinion, hiring people simply to write license. They're hiring clerks to provide service, and this 1 minute out of their hour is a service that they're providing in addition to all their other duties.
I think we had Representative Davis first, and then Representative Logan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I guess I'm puzzled by what the purpose of this legislation is. Is the purpose to raise money for the Fish and Game? Is that or is the purpose to beat 4% of the vendors over the head? Or I can't quite focus on that. And I guess I'll just assume that the purpose is to, for purpose of my comment here, that the purpose is to raise money. If that's the case, it seems like there's two other ways to go that could raise equivalent amounts of money, which would be far more fair. One would be to simply decrease uniformly the rate of compensation across all the vendors. A relatively small decrease in the compensation. If the argument is that they're being overcompensated, that the you know, the clerks that are doing this really doesn't take that much time, then maybe we're paying them too much. And if that, I don't know, I'm going to have to look at it, but if that, for purpose of discussion, were the case, then maybe we should consider reducing the amount that we pay each and every vendor and do it in an even-handed and fair way across the state and across all the vendors. The other thing is, the other approach we could take is, well, if really this is a fair compensation, but we still want, we're concerned about the fish and game budget and want to raise a little money, we could add 25 cents to each license. I mean, there's $17 million worth of sales here. I mean, a relatively, maybe it's a nickel, I don't know, I haven't done the math yet, but it's probably a relatively small amount of money that we could add to each sale. We'd raise that $300,000. And so I would suggest that there are other ways to accomplish what I infer to be the goal here.
Well, certainly, Mr. Chairman, I believe there are two purposes. One, I would like to see Fish and Game have more money, but the overriding purpose to me is reduces state subsidy. It doesn't cost $35,000 to write for one vendor to write those licenses. And they do, as I say, receive a great deal of compensation in the foot traffic that these licenses provide. Speaking to Representative Davey's other point, there's an economy of scale, and the moms and pops that only write, you know, $50 worth of license a year or a few hundred dollars a license a year, I think would be unfairly impacted by reducing everyone's compensation. But again, can you, like I said, you know, record keeping, 1 minute to write the license, can you imagine a store getting $35,000 as a subsidy for clerks that they would normally have to have anyway?
Representative, I'm sorry, Representative Bowden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All due respect, I think it takes a little bit longer than a minute to fill out a license, and I suspect that the dealer, the amount of money they make on a license, they probably make a lot less than if that same clerk was handling a transaction on a retail sale. That would probably make more money. You know, we did just recently raise license fees a couple years ago, if I recall. There was a significant jump in the price of hunting and fishing licenses. I guess I'm a little bit troubled with being in business myself. Granted, the argument can be made you'll bring traffic in and whatnot to sell these licenses, and hopefully they'll make a sale. Otherwise, I just I think this is a fairly good agreement here between the public sector and the private sector to have the private sector help the state out raising revenues. I'm just kind of vacillating whether or not this is how necessary.
From our own personal experience, when I've near the opening of hunting season or fishing season stood there, and you've got one clerk and you've got three people or four people filling out their own license. And I've filled out licenses in both my previous jobs. And you hand people the form and they hand it back when they're through filling out, and you punch the appropriate hole and collect the money. It's not brain surgery. I'm looking at certainly not wanting to penalize private enterprise. They deserve their opportunity. I'm not sure that I want to keep, as in many cases we have in this state, subsidizing them with state money. And I don't look at us taking from private enterprise their justly earned wages. I'm saying that let's reduce this subsidy and keep in the state coffers a little bit more money.
Representative Osterman?
Okay.
Did you have some? Representative Kai?
I would just ask Bruce a question. How long ago did we implement 5% and the cap? How long has it been in place?
To the chair, Representative Cott, I'd have to grab my statute book to see when that was enacted, but it's been there for quite some time. It's certainly not anything recent, and but it would just take me a minute to find that out. I can't answer off the top of my head, but I could find it out quickly for you.
I guess that's the point I was trying to get across. It hasn't been something that's been done recently. It's been in place for quite some time. I assume the costs when it was implemented were much lower than they are today with inflation. And if we're looking at privatizing many aspects of government, I think it's a bad message to send out there. Yeah, we're going to privatize issuing driver's license. If you want to do it, we'll give you a dollar. But watch out, 2 years from now, we may want to come back and say, well, maybe a quarter is what we really want to give you. I don't think we ought to move in the opposite direction if the direction we're heading is for privatization of some of the government services. And just as a side note, the one-minute routine, my wife works at, actually, it's the number one unit sales location, and it takes her quite a bit more than a minute. There's verifications, there's people who don't understand, of course, maybe because of their transitionary time in their life, what address to put down in the license, and then she verifies it based on a driver's license. So her words, and I can remember them very vividly, was she wished that they didn't even issue licenses there. It's a pain in the
Excellent control.
And I think Representative Cott makes my point. If it wasn't important to provide this service, they wouldn't, because there is a record keeping involved. And so what I'm saying is, do we have to keep subsidizing them at this level for them to provide the service? I think, frankly, these large units would probably write license for nothing or at a loss just to have the traffic. Does the state want to continue a subsidy?
Now, you use the word subsidy as different for the first $10,000 and not afterwards. I mean, if they're getting a dollar, is that a subsidy? That's a payment for service, isn't it?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, using Representative Cott's ideas about the driver's license, certainly we don't expect the private entity to subsidize the state. It ought to be a wash.
I see.
And I did do some research. I looked at capping it at $4,000 or $5,000, which would generate a great deal more money for the state. But that didn't seem fair. And so again, I took someone who was in about the middle and asked them to research what it would cost to write license, and it came up that it costs somewhere between $8,000 and $11,000. In their time, the best, and again, you're having to break out portions of a mm-hmm. person's time. You're probably going to have that employee anyway, whether you write license or not. It's the best I could come up with it. The $10,000 seemed to be fair compensation for what the average vendor was spending in time to write license.
Representative Davies?
Chair Wilson. So it seems from the discussion that the sponsor is focusing on the fact that it really doesn't cost as much or they're compensated in other ways. And so I would just reiterate that I think if that's the case, we've got to be more even-handed about reducing the benefit if we're going to do this. And secondly, I would note that if you compare, say, 13,000 unit sales to a total compensation of $35,000, you're talking about $3 a unit for the processing of that. And most of the estimates I've seen for what it costs an office to process a single piece of paper is closer to in the $10 range. And so it looks to me like they already are subsidizing it's not just writing the ticket, but there's other bookkeeping that has to go along with it, has been testified. So to process this piece of paper for a total compensation of $3 a unit is I think in the marketplace a bargain. It doesn't. In other words, the point I'm saying is it doesn't seem to me that there's any evidence here, at least on its face, that there's a gross overcompensation going on that needs to be reduced.
Any other comments, questions? Yes, Representative Cott.
Well, then I guess what your friend from Fairbanks is suggesting is that his second approach would be more appropriate, and that is to raise licenses by a small amount, if it is in fact part of the problem that we're trying to get to, is to generate more issues.
Does Fish and Game have any comment on this twist or change of events?
Mr. Chairman.
Or am I putting you on the spot?
Well, certainly, you know, from our standpoint, there is definitely an advantage to increasing the revenues to the Fish and Game Fund by this legislation, and it's not too many times in this building that I see people offering to provide additional money to the Department of Fish and Game these days, so that looks good to us. As far as how you want to accomplish it, just my personal opinion, I think Representative Bundy has an argument about the efficiency involved here and whether or not there is actually a subsidy occurring to the larger vendors. And I think to answer that question definitively, you'd really have to do some kind of analysis that hasn't been done yet to see what is the actual cost of issuing a license. I certainly appreciate what Representative Davies is making and in the argument that he's making, and in the absence of any more specific analysis, you know, I can't really argue that his estimate is inaccurate, but like I imagine everybody in this room, I have purchased licenses too, and I know basically who does most of the work, and it's usually the person purchasing the license who fills it out. And so anyhow, that's just general comments on that particular twist, as you called it. The department does have one request in the way of an amendment to the bill, and that has to do with an effective date. It would be much more orderly for any transition dealing with the license system to occur at the beginning of the calendar year, because our license contracts are signed on a calendar year, the stock is put out on a calendar year, and et cetera. So we would like to see this bill have an effective date that would be January 1 of the year that it was enacted.
January 1 of the year was enacted, or January 1 of the following year?
Well, whatever year, it became law.
Okay.
Yes.
Representative Bundy.
Mr. Chairman, regarding the license fee twist, it wasn't all that long ago, 3-4 years at most, that the license in Alaska were essentially doubled. And I would strongly encourage you to check with your constituents before you talk about raising their license fee, that opportunity is going down, prices have gone up. In my personal opinion, I think the license in Alaska are a bargain compared to other states where you buy just a basic license and you get the tags all thrown in. If you want to explore that, I will certainly help you in that area, but I'd like to have you in front as a shield.
Representative Cott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In response to Representative Bundy, I've talked with a number of my constituents, and they've all suggested that we ought to increase non-resident tags.
Not in my backyard.
Any other questions of the sponsor or a Fish and Game? Yes, Representative Nicolai.
Yeah, I do have a comment. I think that if you do enact this bill, that it's only going to be a one-time savings, and that the impacts on on the vendors is that you would only be reducing the vendors. I don't think that they would take the time up from their employees to enact this legislation, because it'd be a loss to their the value of what their employee is there for, and the value is that they're trying to make money. And so I think you would only be impacting the Fish and Game. The Fish and Game Department is going to have to install an office probably to sell the license, Fish and Game licenses, to make everybody legal. And I think that you're going to only be reducing the vendors. I don't think you'll see these vendors on the front page come out and sell them. And just looking at the sales here, I mean, there's a lot of sales here in the larger communities here in Alaska. And I think that if you shut these people down, then you're only hurting your own department.
Representative Ogden?
Mr. Chairman, I think what I'm hearing from the committee is that they have a little bit of a problem with just cutting it off at a flat $10,000. Maybe if, just for the sake of discussion, some kind of a sliding scale rather than just once you reach the $10,000 cap, that's it. You know, might be more appropriate and possibly more palatable to the people in the committee. Does the sponsor like to comment on that?
Well, yes, Mr. Chairman. I guess it was sliding, in my opinion, right up to 10,000. But remember, the people below 10,000 don't get all 10,000. They get their normal compensation per unit up to 10,000, and then it caps off. If it would be the committee's preference, I mean, I could do some research in this area and come back with a CS with the enthusiasm for the idea that's been shown so far. I don't have a need to hang my head on the wall. As regarding the the analysis of the people, the subsidies, I've worked in that area, and they either won't or can't provide that information. Obviously, if I'm saying I'm thinking about cutting your subsidy, how about giving me a little help in this? they say, yeah, raise the taxes on that guy that lives down the block.
Representative Codd.
Hey, Mr. Chairman. I don't think my concern is basically a sliding scale. I think it gets more to the heart of what Representative Davies suggested, is that there's a process that you're involved. It could be, as high as $3. It may be higher. That's a good deal, a good bargain for our money. I think what I would like to see or hear is some testimony or at least some letters of support from some of these top sellers to give us an idea. I mean, I'm using a biased opinion to support my argument. I mean, I have someone close to me that issues these. Maybe it's so biased and tainted that I need to hear from some of the other ones, and there's no letters of support or anything here that indicates exactly what it costs to process or administer the licenses. I think that might be a little more palatable and appropriate.
Well, I think we've heard considerable debate on this, and I think there have been some valid questions raised, and it would be my suggestion that we hold this bill, allow you to perhaps come up with a CS, or perhaps even discuss this. You don't have to necessarily bring back the results, but to know whether or not, for example, companies like Long's would continue to sell because of the sales advantage of having people come in for a license. They'll also pick up some lures and on and on and on. If we had some, other than opinion, if we had something like Representative Codd indicated, some sort of a letter that said, yeah, we don't like it, but we'll continue selling, anything like that, I think it would be to our advantage. So I'm going to hold the bill over, and we'll bring it up at a later date.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next, we'll take up Senate Bill 3. Senator Duncan is the prime sponsor.
Yeah. You're welcome.
Senator, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 3, bringing up for hearing today. The bill that was introduced last legislative session may have even gone through this committee and didn't make it through the process, I think, ended up in the House Finance Committee. And it's basically the same bill that was considered last year. It would allow fishermen, or will allow fishermen, to form associations to collectively negotiate raw or processed fish prices with processors. It clearly does not authorize processors to agree among themselves on the prices they will pay fishermen. It only covers collective bargaining between fishermen and a processor, or fishermen and a group of processors. This really, in my mind, is a first step, but an important first step, in stabilizing Alaska's fishing industry. The exemption in this bill, of course, applies only to state antitrust laws. It will still be necessary to gain congressional approval for a federal exemption so that fishermen and processors could negotiate prices. But I believe that that can be done, and only done after action on the state level. And once the legislature has approved SB 3, the state, fishermen, and processors would be in a position to request the federal exemption. So and it's likely, quite likely, of course, that the attitude toward a federal exemption would be much more favorable now that, or will be much more favorable now that Alaska's congressional delegation is in the majority. So I'm optimistic that if we take the action on the state level to get the exemption, that we can then move forward on a federal level. So this is only a first step, and I want to emphasize that, but it's an important first step. In order to permit collective bargaining, fishermen must be allowed to market and sell their fish as a group. There's also a problem with current state antitrust law. It does not mention whether fishermen could collectively sell their raw catch or fish products, although it permits them to form associations to catch and prepare their fish for market. Senate Bill 3 also clarifies this ambiguity, making state law consistent with federal law, which expressly permits fishermen to collectively engage in more activities, including marketing their fish. The incongruities between current state and federal law make it possible for some fishermen's organizations to be in compliance with federal antitrust law, yet not complying with state, yet breaking state law, or be in compliance with state antitrust law and violating federal law. This legislation, or legislation such as this, in pursuit of the corresponding federal exemption, were recommended in a 1993 Alaska Attorney General's report on the Bristol Bay sockeye salmon industry. I believe you should have, or hope you have copies of that report available in your packet. The fishing industry is Alaska's largest private employer and affects every segment of our economy, from small coastal villages to the state's general fund. The long-term price agreements, which could result from collective bargaining, will help stabilize commercial fishing prices, bolstering local and state economies, and stable raw fish prices will promote stable consumer prices for processed seafood products, which means greater sales of Alaska foods. I think you've also been provided, Mr. Chairman, with letters of support from a variety of fishing organizations and others who have been following the legislation. There should also be letters of support from the Department of Commerce and from the Department of Labor, and I'm hopeful individuals from those agencies and also from other organizations are here to testify on the legislation.
Any questions for sponsor, Representative Green?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, I apologize. My mind wandered or something. You made an I'm sorry, reference to if this would be in line with state antitrust but opposed or out of kelter with federal antitrust or the other way around, and I didn't follow what you said after that.
I said what this bill does, of course, is address the state antitrust laws and gives the exemption on the state level, and that's the first step that needs to be taken. There also then has to be, we have to gain congressional approval as a second step for a federal exemption. You get the state exemption and then also the federal exemption. This needs to be done on a state level. Once this is done, then we, with this in hand, with the state exemption given, we can then go to our congressional delegation and ask them to pursue a federal exemption.
If I might follow up, so it would be your thought that let's assume that everything happened right and that this was an exemption from state antitrust, then you would still not be able to exercise that until such time as it was...
As you had the federal exemption.
Was granted from federal, and there could be some time in there.
Sure.
Okay.
Probably wouldn't happen overnight, but I'm hopeful with our congressional delegation and the positions that they're in that they could actively pursue that and get it accomplished, yes.
Any other questions?
If there are none others. This establishes a price floor, and I'm concerned with if the price floor being established, I would assume, on American dollars, if there were some transactions being conducted with foreign operation where the fluctuation of the ratio of dollars to yen, for example, or dollars to whatever other kind of currency there is, and there was a floor placed on American dollars, and then there was a, say, a locker full of fish that they were going to sell, and the foreign currency exchange rate changed, would there be a chance of violating that floor if they sold it because, the say, the yen dropped 10% and they sold it? Is there any possibility by having this floor that we get into any all kinds of problems with currency exchange?
Well, I don't, maybe someone from the Department of Commerce wants to reply to that. I don't think that's a problem. It's actually really not establishing a floor, Mr. Chairman. We're not establishing a floor here. What we're doing is giving fishermen, once we get this exemption both on the state and federal level, we're allowing fishermen through associations to form associations to collectively negotiate for raw fish prices with processors. So it's not necessarily establishing a floor. We're setting up a process where they can where fishermen can be involved in establishing what the price will be by collectively bargaining, by negotiating.
Any
And this would be, I'm sorry, I'm not that familiar with the bill. This would be a once-a-year thing? How would this...
Well, you know, I'm not sure whether it would be a once-a-year thing or how they would want, how it would handle, probably at least once a year at a minimum, as before the fishing season began, they'd be negotiating for fish price. Perhaps someone from the fishing organizations could better respond to that, but I would say at a minimum at least once a year.
Once a year?
Pardon?
Once a year?
I don't know.
Oh, I thought you were.
You probably a question better be asked of someone from the fishing groups who are here who I think can testify on the legislation.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Sure.
Any other questions? I have one. This has to do with, and maybe someone in the audience can answer this also if you don't. At the end of the year, the fishermen receive some increased pay. I forgot what they call it. At the end of the year, what is it?
Petrol or a bonus?
Yeah. How would you know how this would affect that portion of it?
Oh, I think Jerry McCune knows.
Good.
He knows how to pronounce it anyway.
Okay, Senator. If there's no other questions for the senator, we'll go to the teleconference.
Okay, thank you.
Will someone be here to answer questions? If
yes, I have another question.
Okay. we'll start with Kodiak. We have a Mr. Bruce Scatler.
Good morning. My name is Bruce Schockler.
Schockler.
I'm sorry, here representing Area Cape Standards Association, which represents the 380 same permit holders in Kodiak. This is a very, very important bill, not only to us, but to every person in the fishing industry. What it does, it gives us the opportunity to be involved in a business-like manner with the fish processors, and actually the opportunity to be involved at all levels of price negotiation. And it's something that's been missing for a long time, and as the world markets change and everything from the retail buyers to the wholesale buyers change, we need to be able to have some type of input and some type of business relationship with those buyers. And that is what this does. Presently, to do business in this manner, we have to go outside the state of Alaska, which we are presently doing. We are licensed to do business in the state of Washington, or should I say contracted to do business as a marketing organization in the state of Washington, where this type of legislation allows it, and then licensed to do business in Alaska. This isn't doing anything other than pretty much letting us do business like everybody else in the world does. We're a little bit behind. And I just want to say that this is not setting a floor, it's not setting a ceiling, it's not casting anything in concrete, it's not forcing anyone to do business in any particular way. All it is doing is giving us the opportunity. It's enabling us by law to do business the way the rest of the world does. And we just support this thing completely, and we're real glad to see that Alaska is going to step up to the way of doing business, the rest of the world, and the rest of the United States is doing it. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. Any questions? No. Thank you. Next, we'll go to Petersburg. We have a Miss Chris. No, I'm not going to try that one.
Norris.
Norris.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chris Norris. I'm Executive Director of Southeast Alaska Painters. I'd like to start out by saying that we're in full support of Senate Bill 3 as presented. We concur with the comments of Mr. Schockler from Kodiak. The bill serves two purposes, as the Senator told you earlier. It clarifies ambiguity currently found in state law concerning fishermen's ability to collectively market their catch. And secondly, the bill would move us closer to obtaining a much-needed federal exemption so that fishermen and processors would be allowed to negotiate prices. Passage of this bill would put the state fishing industry in a much better position to request such an exemption from the federal government. value for Alaska seafood products, which will directly benefit both the state and local economies. We appreciate the forward thinking presented in this bill and strongly urge you to support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Any questions? Not? Thank you. Next, we'll come back to Juno here.
Is that all we have on teleconference?
Yeah. Scott Gellister.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm a Southeast Saner. I've been instrumental in working with Southeast Saners on this. I know, I think, about as much as any of the fishermen in the state about this, although I cannot represent myself as a antitrust expert. I do know from a business standpoint what this would do for me and the high-volume fish producers of this state. I also am a member of Erie K. Saners. I'm a member of UFA, United Fishermen's Association, and in conversations with people in the last month, well, 2 months that I've been talking around about this bill and these organizations, there is a lot of support for this bill at large among all these organizations. And we at Southeast Saners Association and at United Saners Association support this bill in its current form. We view this as a very forward-minded bill and look forward to the potential benefits this bill provides if adopted. In its current form, SB 3 provides a catalyst to bond this salmon industry we have in Alaska together. This antitrust exemption will allow fishermen and processors to consolidate their interests in the marketplace and negotiate prices competitively from a unified position of power in markets worldwide. We don't have the mechanism. We don't operate under a law that allows us to do this. Other fish producers of the world already enjoy this type of marketing advantage. There's no better example to Alaskans than the Norwegians' cooperative marketing worldwide of their salmon products. They don't, as fish farmers, compete with each other for markets. They don't, as processed products, go into the marketplace competing with each other for a share of the market and ultimately discount their product just to sell product. They go into the marketplace as a total block of product. This bill potentially, once allowed to form relationships and consolidate the industry to a degree, allows these types of blocks of Alaska salmon products to form in the world marketplace and go forward and truly be competitive, I think. Southeast Alaska Saners Association and USA strongly urges the passage of this bill in its current form. This bill could well prove to be, I think, the most significant commercial fisheries legislation to cross this hill since statehood. It really puts this industry in a position of power to market its products worldwide. And I'd like to thank Senator Duncan and his staff for their parts in sponsoring and supporting this bill. And we look forward to seeing this bill passed into law. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. Dean Pata.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dean Paddock, and I'm speaking in behalf of the members of the Bristol Bay Drift Netters Association, which is not an association which has negotiated prices. We're not a marketing organization, but we are very concerned about issues related to marketing, such as this one. I fully believe that it's the intent of the sponsor of this bill to smooth, to ameliorate the process that now exists, which frankly is primarily notable for a total lack of process. At the present time, fishermen are price takers. We have been price takers for time immemorial. And we operate under a very restrictive set of legal constraints. And we see this bill as something which will free up those legal constraints and allow us to join with the processors as price makers. The market relationship between fishermen and those to whom they sell their product has been changing in recent years. Of course, everything changes, but this is undergoing a quantum leap in evolutionary progress, because there was a time, I can remember 30 years ago, when the costs of the processor were very closely regarded, very closely guarded proprietary secrets. But now, practically every fisherman out there has a pretty good idea, if he's at all interested and wants to find out, what all those costs are. In fact, a couple years ago here, the fishermen urged you folks to vote in a 1% assessment, a certain percentage of which was dedicated to providing all the permit holders in the state of Alaska with salmon market information, which we are now receiving, which of course increases our knowledge of what those costs are, among other factors that concern us in the marketplace. We believe that this legislation is desperately needed. If you've ever had the misfortune of seeing a Bristol Bay strike or the after effects of a Bristol Bay strike, which is sometimes much more subtle, you'd realize how important it is to the industry for you to take this step forward. Sometimes those after effects last for years. Sometimes they're more immediate. Probably the worst case that I've ever seen, Mr. Chairman, if I can be allowed a brief anecdote, was a situation a few years ago when one individual went out and fished when everybody else was saying, we're not going to fish until we get such and such a price. And he came back and he found that some of his friends and contemporaries had poured acid all over his nets. Well, he went fishing again, and the situation began to fester. When he came in a little later on, he took a few drinks, and he decided to retaliate. And he ended up charging about, crashing into the boats of those whom he suspected of having ruined his financial investment in fishing gear. And somewhere along the line, he lost it totally, and I did not get to see it, but the individual who told me about it, he was finally reduced to impotence at low tide out in the middle of a Bristol Bay tide flat by gentlemen dressed in brown and blue, and he was seated in the mud, wrapped in chains, at which point he was removed. And I haven't seen him back since. I like to believe that if we had the ability to participate in more of a process such as is envisioned by this First Step legislation, that unfortunate situations like that can be avoided. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? If not, thank you very much, Dean. Dwight Perkins, Department of Labor.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Dwight Perkins, Department of Labor. Excuse me one second. I've got to get my... I left my position paper on back here. The Department of Labor does support this bill. Senate Bill 3 would allow fishers to form associations to negotiate fish prices. Alaska Statute 16.10.280 provides that the Department of Labor serve as mediator of disputes between fishers and fish processors on the price to be paid for salmon. The Department's experience has revealed that the inability of fishers to form associations to negotiate with processors has been a primary factor in such disputes as the 1991 Bristol Bay strike. This legislation would provide a mechanism to stabilize raw fish prices, thereby protecting Alaskan fishers and processors from the debilitating and extreme fluctuation in fish prices. A stable fishing industry will have a direct and positive effect on the Alaskan economy. It is only reasonable that the Alaska fishers and processors have the legal ability to protect themselves and this important resource from price setting by outside interests. I'm available for any questions you may have.
Any questions? Representative Cott.
Hey, Mr. Chairman. Dwight, nice to see you in front of resources. Something different. On page 2, line 12, it's itemized number 2, where I guess the fishermen would be able to set the minimum price. If a processor did not meet that minimum price collectively in the whole, in my understanding of this, then the fishermen here in Alaska could take their business to a foreign processor. Is that how this would read or not?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cott. That particular item, you know, the department would be there to help mediate disputes between the two individuals, the two groups. Whether or not they could take that to another entity or on the outside market, I couldn't answer that question. I don't know if Commerce or
maybe. I suggest that Donna Parker from Commerce can answer that question.
Are there any other?
That wasn't a labor question.
I bet you get the governor to approve that. No foreign processes can come in U.S. waters.
Can't get to
okay.
The governor approves it.
Are there any other questions for? If not,